From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome again to Deconstructing Dinner, a weekly one-hour radio show and podcast heard on radio stations around the world, including our newest edition in one of Canada's newest radio stations, CFAD Salmo, British Columbia. This show is produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, BC. I'm John Steinman, and today we continue with recordings from the Kootenai Harvest Revival, a two-day event held here in Nelson that celebrated the return of a local grain economy here within the southern interior of the province. The event was hosted by the Nelson Creston Grain CSA, the All Seasons Cafe, and Deconstructing Dinner. Last week we heard recordings from day one of the event when Nelson's Capitol Theater hosted a series of speakers who shared the history of food production in the region with the hope that through exploring what was once possible to grow, process, and consume locally, the community could then be inspired to envision what might be possible to revive. Certainly, the community-supported agriculture project for grain that sparked the event is one of those possibilities that is now walking the talk. Today's broadcast will continue with the remainder of those speakers, and we'll hear a brief segment of a theatrical performance by Richard Roberry. We'll hear from author and farmer Lou Ann Armstrong, Grain CSA farmer Keith Huscroft, and musician Bessie Wobb. First, just a quick clarification. I believe last week I did suggest that the Kootenai Harvest Revival series here on the show would be a two-part series, but it will actually extend into next week's broadcast as well, and so you can expect more recordings from the event next week. This Harvest Revival series of recordings is part of our Local Grain Revolution series, and if you missed any of those broadcasts, they are, as usual, archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. Now, in last week's episode, we heard speakers at the event share the food ways of the area's original human inhabitants, the Sinaiext Interior Salish or Arrow Lakes people. Again, if you heard that segment but did not get a chance to view the excellent slides that accompany that presentation, the slides are linked to from the November 6th, 2008 broadcast posted on our website. We also heard from J.J. Varigan, who shared the history of the region's Dukabor community that also has a rich history of living off the land. But next on the evening's agenda was Richard Roberry, a local actor, writer, historian, and he played the character of a deceased Nelson farmer who was conjured up following his death in 1927. In order to share the history of some of the area's earliest orchardists. The Kootenai region of the province was once one of the more well-known fruit-producing regions in North America, and the apples, cherries, and strawberries grown here developed quite a solid reputation. Here's a brief segment from that performance.
1901, there were 12,447 on the rolls of the West Kootenai ridings of Nelson and Slocan. 19 households in 9 communities were involved in farming, plus the Chinese, of course, who were not on the voting rolls. And that's all there were. All the food was shipped up from Spokane. And so there we were, and we toiled. We cleared the land. We planted. We grew clover and vetch and that sort of thing in order to improve the soil. And it took 5 or 6 years before we were able to produce a crop. But good apples they were, and they did win prizes, and over the years, we did prosper of a sort. Although the problem was, of course, and it's a problem which has plagued farmers from time immemorial, is in a bad year, you don't have anything to sell, so you don't make any money. In a good year, there's so much to sell, it drives the prices down, and you don't make any money. And we didn't on either occasion. Some of us, of course, had private incomes and were able to keep going. We had packing houses at McDonald's Landing and at Proctor. The barges used to come in with CPR boxcars on them. And we'd load up boxcars and we'd send them off to the prairies. The trouble was, The Washington State, just down below, had their apples, quite as good as ours. Well, possibly not quite as good as ours, but almost as good as ours. But they could reach the market 5 to 6 weeks before we could. and the same in the Okanagan, 2 or 3 weeks before we could. And of course, the first apples of spring are the ones that bring the premium dollar. So it was backbreaking work. It was endless backbreaking work. In the wintertime, you had to protect the trees, keep the branches from breaking off. All through the summer, you had to cultivate around the trees. You had to spray them. I think that's what killed me, actually, the spraying. We sprayed them with Paris green, of course, and one of my favorites, arsenic of lead. Charming. They discovered, actually, that it doesn't entirely rub off when you wash it, and in fact it does penetrate somewhat into the apple. They discovered this in 1919, and they worked on finding a substitute, which they finally did in 1947. The substitute was DDT. Brilliant, these scientists. They finally did ban it in 1988. Another was nicotine sulfate. Now, nicotine sulfate, of course, biodegradable, I think they say these days. It breaks down, and so, oh, good. Unfortunately, it's extremely toxic at the point of application, so that the little insects and the birds and the applicator, such as myself, had a rather toxic experience. Well, it wasn't all gloom and doom, however. We did have a rather lively social life. Of course, we're all English and terribly exciting people. We had our tennis courts and our regattas and our dramatics and church. And adulterous relationships and things like that. At least some people did, I didn't. Did I tell you about Buggins? Yes, I did. Pooch? Strawberries. Oh, yes, of course. When you're growing, when you're waiting for the trees to grow up and produce, you've got nothing to sell, so you put in rows of strawberries between them, and in fact, that's what we did, and our strawberries were amazing, and we had a surplus, which we sold to the jam factories, and to the Dukobor factories also. Thank God for them. Many a dollar gained that way. To end it all off, I suppose I should just say that we struggled on. Some of us had, as I say, a private income, so we could, and others had invested all our money in the whole damn enterprise, and we were stuck. And that's about the long and the short of it. And then the Depression came along, as if things weren't bad enough. And nobody would buy our fruit. And then the Second World War, of course. Of course, I was dead by then, thank God.
That was a brief segment of actor Richard Roberry in September 2008 at the Kootenai Harvest Revival in Nelson, B.C. Richard played the part of a deceased Nelson farmer, sharing the area's rich fruit-growing history. In just a moment, we'll hear from two more speakers at this celebratory and educational event held to mark the monumental harvest of grain as part of the Nelson Creston Community-Supported Agriculture Project. But before we do, here again is musician Bessie Wap, whom we heard from on last week's broadcast and who performed a second song at the event.
Welcome back to the second half. I feel I have to admit that I didn't write the first song that I sang. That was written by a woman named Annie Heffer, who lives in Cranbrook and plays with a group called As the Crow Flies. And I was so thrilled to find a song about gardening, because mostly I sing all sad, all country, all the time. So now I'm going to sing one of those songs. And this was written by an American singer-songwriter named Tom Russell. And he wrote a song cycle of songs for each of his ancestors. And this one is called Acres of Corn. When I was a child, well, I spoke as a child. Now I'm a grown woman, but my thoughts are still wild. I thought I'd see London, maybe Paris, but I'm staring at cornfields, and they're staring at me. Well, dreams are just things that you keep in a trunk till the men are out working, or you gotta be drunk. Then you unlock your dreams, but they're tattered and they're torn. So you stare out the window at the acres of corn. Every now and again, will I take a small drink of the blackberry brandy and kept under the sink. I pull out that steam trunk, put on my gown, and I dance through the cornfield till I fall to the ground. Well, dreams are just things that you keep in a trunk till the men are out of working, or you gotta be drunk. Then you unlock your dreams, but they're tattered and they're torn. So you stare out the window at the acres of corn. When I was a child, well, I spoke as a child. Now I'm a grown woman, but my thoughts are still wild.
Thanks very much.
Musician Bessie Wapp performing at the Kootenai Harvest Revival. Now, one topic that has come up on a few occasions here on Deconstructing Dinner is the role of food in creating one's sense of place. That is, food's ability to tie oneself to their home or to the land on which they live. Lou Ann Armstrong is an author and farmer who lives just north of Windle, British Columbia, in the community of Boswell. One of her most recent books is Blue Valleys, an ecological memoir, and she is currently working on a series of essays about land, place, and connection to place. Lou Ann spoke on what the title of farmer means to her. Here's MC Russell Precious introducing Lou Ann Armstrong.
Twice in my life, I went looking for home. Once in the early 70s, and a group of us looked all over southern British Columbia. I've always had really good land karma, and I suppose that's because I need to seek my sense of self through place. So it was a real pleasure a couple of weeks ago when we were on our grain CSA tour in Creston in the East Valley to meet our next presenter, Lou Ann Armstrong. Lou Ann grew up just north of Creston on the East Shore. Her father farmed in the days before the Salmo Creston Pass, so that meant there was a little bit more traffic going down the East Shore. So I'm sure in terms of selling fruits and vegetables, there were some advantages then. I got a sense, being with Lou Ann, of such a strong sense of place that she had. I I at times felt that I was visiting with Wendell Berry, just the fusion of her agricultural roots and her deep cultural roots. Lou Anne is a writer, she's a poet, she's an essayist, she's a publisher and an editor. We're very pleased to have her with us today. She's going to tell us a little bit about what it might mean to be a farmer. Please welcome Lou Anne Armstrong.
I'm so glad to be here. And I'm glad to be here for a very specific reason, because every year, and I just finished doing this, I pick the last of the peaches at my farm. One of the things we grow is peaches. And I love growing peaches primarily just because they're so beautiful. They're wonderful to eat, but they're also just aesthetically, they're the most amazingly beautiful fruit. And so every year I go and I take the dogs and we pick the last two peach trees that are late, and everyone's sick of peaches and I'm sick of peaches, but you know, I fill up the buckets and the baskets with peaches. And I always have this feeling of this kind of odd loneliness. I think, you know, there should be people here. We should be singing. We should be celebrating. Where is everybody? You know, but there's me and there's the wasps and the dogs and the horse and whoever's around. And, you know, we have our own little mini celebration. So it's so wonderful for me to be here, having been a farmer in the Kootenays for 60 years now, to be able to celebrate with all of you. So thank you, thank you, thank you for this wonderful Harvest Festival revival. I hope we do it every year. I'd also really, really, really like to dedicate my talk this evening to my wonderful, amazing parents who, for, you know, our whole lives, fed themselves, fed their four children, fed, especially during the Back to the Land movement. It was just amazing. Everybody came to our farm, and everybody who came to the farm went away with something. You know, a box of apples, a bottle of homemade wine. My father had this amazing system where everything on the farm fed everything else. And so we did, most of my life, grow almost all of our own food, and we were pretty food self-sufficient. He had these four little children that he considered slaves. And so we did learn to work, but we also learned to play, because we had this enormous, wonderful place with the lake and the beach and the mountains and animals, and it really was a paradise to grow up in. And you're quite right, Russell, I could not leave that place. Without it, I would just be some sort of empty shell. I have scuttled away a few times in my life and gotten, a job or a university degree or one of those things, and then scuttle back to the farm, which is where I actually live. When I'm in the city, I sort of camp out for a bit and then go back to the city. But I have been thinking about this word farmer, because it's in the news, and it's interesting to me that, the whole sort of grow your own food is back, and I'm really pleased to see that. But I did write a book about the farm. It's up there. It's called Blue Valleys, and it's for sale. And so now I'm writing a series of essays about land, place, connection to place, because I really do think we need very much in this day and age to think about where we live, not only where we live and how we connect to it, but how we look after it so that it looks after us. So I'm writing a whole book of essays. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what the word farmer means to me, because I think it's a very, very important word, but it's one that has some odd things attached to it. And, my parents were farmers. My grandfather was a farmer. When I look back at my family tree, really, as far back as I can trace it, my family have been farmers. So it's very rooted in me that way, too. I have always thought of myself as a farmer, but this is a self-chosen identity, and it doesn't have that much to do with my real life or how I actually make a living. Labels about things to do with land are various. My landscape architect daughter says she is a gardener, and my neighborhood friend Linda calls herself a peasant, but really it's all vaguely about mucking about in the dirt and playing with plants. I just call myself a farmer, and I'm content. But my son laughs at me for thinking I actually have a farm, and he's right. It's not much of a farm. It's just a clear cut beside the lake, no big business or no big machines, no agribusiness connections, just fruit trees, animals, and me. But this place fed our whole family for over 50 years. My father, my mother, three siblings, and myself. And then it fed my children and my brother and my sister's children as well. And in fact, at one point, I realized that there was 15 or 16 of us that actually got most of our food off the farm. And yes, it was and is always a lot of work. And I did much of that work when I was a child and then when I was a single parent with four kids to feed. So I feel I have somewhat earned the label. But farmer is a word with kind of odd implications. It's one of those words like Indian with romantic stereotypes attached to it, a kind of duality of stereotypes. On the one hand, a farmer is someone sometimes perceived as, you know, close to nature, wise in the ways of animals and plants, someone who can fix anything and can encapsulate a mystical view of the universe in just a few well-chosen words. But on the other hand, the word dumb always seems to be silently appended to farmer, redneck, slow, prejudiced, the butt of jokes, and always male. The odd thing about farming and gardening is as long as you do it as a hobby, you don't really get labeled with that pejorative dumb farmer. You can be a gentleman farmer. That's different from being a real farmer because you actually have money as opposed to real farmers who don't have any. Or you can be a hobby farmer and you can have your place in the country where you garden obsessively and even have happy cows. But a real farmer is forever, no matter how wealthy, in the lowest class you can be in. Mud and manure on your boots and in your brain as well. These days, for some reason, people don't seem to want to be farmers anymore. And a lot of Western civilization has, in fact, been crawling out of that class and into the urban condo, something far more respectable. Becoming a farmer seems to mean going down a long notch in the class war and taking on a very complex and contradictory image. So despite the romance and the beauty and the great food and all those other benefits, being a farmer has an old and rather venerable image problem. Somehow shit on the boots translates to shit in the brain. These days, when I walk to the barn to do the chores, I find that I walk like my father. I walk in his footsteps, and of course, I'm walking in his life. I walk on his land. There is a farmer's walk. It's slow, it's bent, but steady. Farming is all walking, working, stooping, lifting. It's all physical, and there's no point in rushing it. The trick in farm work is just to keep going. And as I get older, I have become more like my father and probably much like his father and his father and his father because gender doesn't really enter into it. Superficially, in every way, I'm completely unlike them. I'm a female, I'm a writer, I'm an academic, I'm an environmentalist, I'm a feminist, all of those things they would have hated. And yet none of this really matters on the way to the barn. The ritual and the rule bred into my bones as old as human beings. You take care of animals before you feed yourself, you check on everything, you put the farm to bed before you come in at night. It always amuses me that prostitution gets labeled the oldest profession. The obvious oldest profession is farming. Farming is only about food and survival. It's really not about anything else. Any romance about it is just that, furbelows and frills. Farming is fundamental. It is about food, and thus it is also about dirt, hard work, being outside in every kind of weather, and of course it's also about birth and death. It's relentless. Farming never stops, although it does kind of slow down in the winter. There's nothing that can be put on hold. Fruit can be green one day, ripe the next, and rotten the day after. Animals always have to be cared for first. Plus, keeping animals means you get to love and care for them, and then you have to kill them. My father loved his animals, although he never let us see that. We only knew it accidentally by coming on him crying when a calf had died or when he had to shoot an old dog. But he was very fast and skilled at butchering. Last year, my brother, with whom I now share the farm, and I had to come to terms with this ourselves because our father had died, and now there is only us to do the killing and butchering. My brother had raised a bunch of pigs. We always like pigs. They're smart and they're funny, and we get very attached to them. We take them for walks down to the beach. We scratch their ears and we give them names. They are easy to feed and delicious to eat. The day my brother decided to butcher last year was pouring rain. It was late November. He'd been putting it off, and now it was getting very late in the season. So he decided to try something someone he'd heard. He fed the first pig a mixture of grain and beer, thinking this would calm the pig down and make it sleepy, and then he would shoot it in its sleep. Somehow, that would make it easy. But the beer just made the pig really, really happy. I went over to the barn to see how things were progressing, and there was my tall, silent brother, ankle deep in the mud, head bare to the pissing rain, while the pig galloped clumsily and happily from one end of the pig pen to the other, kicking up its feet and then falling over. There wasn't much I could do to help, so I left and I went back to the house, and after I left, I heard the shot. I went back out, but there wasn't much to be done. My father skinned out the pig and threw the pigs, the legs to the dogs and put the carcass in his truck. And then he came in the house to get warm. And he sat at the table that was our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents. And finally he said, "Dad was really fast." And then he said, "I like to be alone to do this." All of which I understood. All the subtext was there. Missing our father and the sense of being alone and grown up and responsible adults finally at 50. And the harshness and the duty and the beauty of killing the pig. Good meat for winter, safe, healthy meat, and work we felt good about. We exchanged some small talk about the butcher and when the meat would be ready, and then he left. I contend that there are really two kinds of people in the world, the people who grow food and the people who cook it. I just grow it. What I like about growing food is texture, color, shape, the sense of abundance, the sensuousness of it all. For example, the way the late August light glimpses off a basket of pink and purple eggplants, red and green peppers, yellow and orange tomatoes, and those big orange turban squash. I revel in the satisfaction of picking things, but then I have to find someone else to help turn it into something, to do all that canning, pickling, drying, baking, juicing, and freezing. I love this process as well, but I really love to do it with other people, and I like that sense of community and shared effort when there's a bunch of us around the table, peeling peaches, for example, and slicing them onto trays for the dryer. But because small-scale agriculture is mostly tedious physical work, the more people there are, the more food could be produced. A small farm can actually feed a lot of people quite easily, but the work is intense, and so that old adage of many hands make light work is exactly right. But this means a small subsistence farm is about community, whether you want it to be or not. It's about geographical community, and it's about family. You don't choose who you're related to, and you don't choose who moves in next door as your neighbor. If you all live there and you have to get along and you have to do the work to feed yourselves, you have no choice. You get along or you leave. Small farming is about depending on your family and neighbors, and so it's at once both oddly dependent and yet it's this amazing source of independence from systems, corporations, governments, and those loathsome grocery stores. So why do I call myself a farmer? And why have I stuck to this label so intensely? I actually really like at academic conferences to introduce myself as a farmer because it's quite funny to watch people's faces when they're, because they, you know, they see me and I'm there and I'm a doctor and I'm an academic and I'm calling myself a farmer and they just don't get it. Why have I stuck to this label? I've asked myself this question for many years with no real answer. But I've asked myself this not only walking to the barn in the winter to feed the animals, but standing in the muddy, freshly turned garden soil in early April, planting the first seeds, or in early June, stuffing my mouth full of new spinach, or in the summer, wandering the peach trees, bucket in one hand, looking for that first, that earliest, that just finally gotten ready peach. or in the late fall, putting the garden away, pulling the last onions, cutting corn stalks with the chill October breeze rattling the leaves. I have never made any money farming, and I never expect to. Mostly I give a lot of food away these days, plus I eat really, really well. My complicity here is that I don't identify as just a farmer. Of course, I have all those other labels to fall back on, depending on where I am and who I'm talking to. But farmer is always the word that tugs at my heart, or perhaps at my feet. It's there among the fundamentals, digging shit out of the pig pen, for example, that I find my own particular and peculiar sense of freedom within those boundaries of belonging, of connection, and of work that is fundamental because it is just that. It is work that feeds me, feeds my family, feeds my community. I'm very well aware that right now this is kind of an intellectual luxury, that even though I don't have much money, I can buy packaged food if I need to, and on nights when I'm feeling really lazy, I can go to the local pub for a pizza. And I'm also very aware that for several thousand years, farming wasn't a luxury. It was the way generation after generation of us survived, and that small farmers are an independent and really hard-headed lot. And as long as they cling to the land, separate from politics, armies, and the changing fortunes of whatever kind of nation state they happen to be in, they would survive. So perhaps that's the connection. That's why, as a writer, I cling to this word, this label, this old-fashioned, outmoded, roots-in-antiquity lifestyle. It's that sense of independence, of being outside, of not ever having to care about the latest, whatever it might be, being outside even of history, outside of time itself. It's the ultimate in arrogance, in fact. It enables me to think what I want and to live how I want, and my feet coming down on the earth in tune with some ancient rhythm that even I am only dimly conscious of. But it's one that lets me live and breathe inside my own empire of time and beauty, abundance, and space. Thank you so much.
Luann Armstrong speaking in September 2008 in Nelson, British Columbia.
The average cable or satellite TV bill runs a viewer $45 per month.
The average daily newspaper subscription, $30.
Internet, $35.
Magazine subscription, $30.
A book a month, $24.95.
Deconstructing Dinner's weekly one-hour episodes, free.
We believe in media being accessible to everyone, regardless of income. And for those of you who are able to support this radio project, please donate when you can or become a voluntary monthly subscriber by visiting deconstructingdinner.ca. Or for more information on how to send a check or money order, call 250-352-9600.
Deconstructing Dinner, helping ensure a perpetual harvest.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner, a weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY, in Nelson, British Columbia. You're listening to recordings from the Kootenai Harvest Revival, a celebratory event held to honor the monumental harvest of grain from Canada's first community-supported agriculture project, 4Grain. In the fall of this year, 180 residents of Nelson and Creston, along with one business, will receive their share of 5 grains grown locally as part of an innovative project to revive a local grain economy. Deconstructing Dinner has been documenting the evolution of this project as part of our Local Grain Revolution series, and in September we teamed up with the CSA project and a local restaurant to host the Kootenai Harvest Revival, a 2-day event held to both celebrate and inspire. Part one of the event's recordings, along with the previous 3 broadcasts on the CSA, are available on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. You were just listening to author and farmer Luann Armstrong. Luann's most recent book is Blue Valleys, an ecological memoir. Luann farms and lives in Boswell, just north of the Creston Valley. Speaking next at the event was a now familiar voice on the show, farmer Keith Huscroft, one of the 3 farmers who this year grew grain for the Creston Grain CSA. And here again is MC Russell Precious.
There are a couple of reasons why we call this event a revival. And of course, one of them is the revival of local agriculture in a generic sense. But we were also motivated by the very specific revival of the grain growing in the Creston area. That is grain that was grown and consumed locally. In the early days, the marketing boards were set up to support the farmers in the consolidating of their crops. The BC Tree Fruit Marketing Board was such an entity, as was the Canadian Wheat Board. But in the case of Creston, until 1998, it required that, as I understand, that all grain be shipped to the prairies. So the Nelson-Creston Grain CSA was a revival of grain being grown locally and consumed locally. For the last number of years, I've been driving regularly between Boulder, Colorado, and Nelson here, my home. And, you know, when you drive 1,000 miles through Colorado, Wyoming, and Montana, when you come in through Cranbrook, there's a moment when you come through the mountains, and there is the Kootenai Valley and Creston, and that body of water after 1,000 miles of dry land, and you feel like you've reached heaven. And when we were visiting several weeks ago, again, it was very heavenly, and particularly the part of Creston I've always liked is the part that nestles up against the mountains in the southeast corner, the area called Lister. And our next speaker, Keith Housecroft, is a fourth-generation farmer in Lister. He's logged with horses. He's farmed with horses. He's one of our three grain growers this year, and would like to have a very warm welcome for Keith Housecroft.
Well, I'm glad that Luann came up with that wonderful prose, because now it's going to change. While researching agriculture in the Creston Valley, I came to understand that I'm not going to be able to tell you everything that went on there in 15 minutes, and I was really glad to see the display there, because I'm not going to talk about agriculture in the Creston Valley. I'm going to talk about my family, how they came, and how their contribution to agriculture. 167 years ago, my great-grandfather was recruited out of an orphanage in England by the Mormons. He took a ship to New Orleans, spent the winter, and then pushed a cart from there to Utah, which I think was a fairly long trip. Spent 20 years getting a trade, married, and at that time Brigham Young was in control, and had an eye on his wife, or my great-grandmother, and their first three children. Deciding it was a good time to leave, he left with the U.S. military after they came in and did some cleanup, whatever, and went back and took a wagon back to Missouri, which is a long trip back. 20 years later, he returned to Utah after Brigham Young was dead, stayed a couple more years, and then with his family that was now up to 7, loaded up 3 heavy wagons with 65 horses and 20 head of cattle, and headed back for English territory, which happened to be the Creston Valley, because he'd heard wonderful things about the Creston Flats and how it was as fertile as the Nile Valley. So it took him 2 years to get from Provo, Utah, to the Creston Valley. He got here in September 1st, 1891, and settled on the Creston Valley, started milking cows, became the first milk, or the first dairy farmer, I guess, selling milk to a paddle wheeler, stern wheeler, that went between Bonners and Caslow, digging ore or whatever. And that went pretty well until the next spring, when after a giant snow, they had a melt and a huge storm, and it overdid the dikes and chased him right off the flats and up into the high ground, and his house decided to follow, because after a great big storm, they went back down, and the house wasn't where they left it. It was on the bank of the river, on the opposite side of the river where they left, so it tried to follow him up. It, too, wasn't happy with the floodwaters down there. So they let go of their the deed that they had on the flatland, and they took it up to the high ground, which is Lister, and together deeded about a section of land, 600 acres, and proceeded to carve a farm and a living out of that. My great-grandfather, he learned quite a bit in Utah with irrigation and with horses and shovels, dug himself a ditch 2 miles long to bring a creek at the right height to his farmland, and which included a 200-foot trestle over a 30-foot ravine or coulee or whatever, which I find a lot of work. They worked their asses off. Compared to now, they were really something. I horse logged a little bit. I didn't do it for the money because we never made any. I think I did it primarily for the rush, the endorphin rush. You know, after you're injured and you get the endorphins kind of come over and they give you that nice feeling. Well, after a day of being rolled, swatted, kicked, nicked, and whacked, I'd come back and I'd sit down and I'd feel better than a crackhead on a cookie binge. Yeah, it was. And I often thought back to my ancestors who actually did this every day and day out. Because, I mean, I only did it for a couple months a year. And actually, for after the second year, I decided I've learned quite a bit about horse logging and I was never going to do it again. They must, considering that they had to do all this without power, without any kind of motive except horses at all, was just an amazing feat. Like, I mean, it wasn't all work. My grandfather, who was 9 years old, oh, this is another thing, trying to find a little history about my family on my side is a little difficult. I mean, my brother or my grandfather's brother and his wife kept meticulous records, and so we know a lot about what happened with the family, but not necessarily with our side. So I came across an old tape that was made in 1966 on the 75th anniversary of the Hus Cross being in Creston. And there is a certain radio personality, and as radio personalities go, they tend to take control of the program because, after all, it is theirs. And he told my grandfather, or proceeded to say everything that my grandfather might have answered him with. Like, you know, what was it like being 9 years old and coming through all this and past all that and dealing with all this stuff, and went on for a couple minutes. Well, it really didn't leave Grandpa much to say. So Grandpa just, there was a pause, and it was radio, of course, and he says it was a long walk. And then you heard the chair scrape, and he got up and left. So they say that history is a small thread of truth over a sea of what is forgotten. So just about everything's forgotten there. So, you know, it's all secondhand what I'm telling you now. It couldn't have been all work because of the little bit of record that we have. There's a blip in the paper in Caslow in about 1906 or something about a hockey game or a hockey team. And my grandpa's name, which was Charles, they said Charlie Huscroft was above, heads above the rest, and because he was a tall bugger, I guess. And, you know, really played his heart out and was the best, by far the best hockey player there. So, you know, he must have had some fun there. And, you know, he worked in the mines. He was a blacksmith. So, and at that time, he was 19 or 20. What came to be a surprise is about 60 years later, when they were checking the signatures on a certain hotel, Charlie's name came up quite a bit. Well, it made sense. Charlie was a blacksmith there. He worked there. But my brother, or my grandpa, also had a brother that lived there, so there was no reason that he should stay at this hotel, except maybe for the fact that it was a brothel. So apparently it wasn't all work for old Gramps. And luckily he didn't get married till about 5 years later, so that saves him from Grandma's wrath, if she should hear me now. Our family made their money mostly selling horses to the miners for about the first 15 years that they were here. After they moved to the high country, the cows were sold or given away, and horses for seemed to be where the money was. In fact, there was such good money in it that my great uncle bought a Percheron stud from France for $2,000 in 1909. So $2,000 in 1909 adds up to quite a bit of money now, and it was well worth it because it made it here in the fall and lived till March, and then it died. Of course, his horses don't breed till May, so So they didn't do too well on that one, which is why after that he went and became a mining engineer and didn't have too much to do with the horses after that. Of course, World War I was at that time, or shortly after that, and both the horse and the cattle market kind of crashed about that time. What was very interesting to me is how frugal they lived. I mean, my grandpa never even owned a car until the 1940s. And they hardly spent any money. They hardly, you know, they didn't go anywhere. And it really, but they were always very happy. My dad and all his siblings said of all the fun that they had on the farm, even though they worked hard, they were, you know, they built them a tennis court and they actually had a lot of fun. And I think it's that sense of family, whereas you're not just a peon or an extra worker, you know, it's your family. And they really enjoyed growing up on that farm. And the farm is still there. I mean, I'm still doing it, and I raised my kids on it. I don't think they quite enjoyed it as much as my dad might have enjoyed it, because I worked them pretty hard.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner. You're listening to farmer Keith Huscroft speaking in September 2008 at the Kootenai Harvest Revival in Nelson, British Columbia.
Here's some facts obscurum. We deal in grain, and grain is dealt in bushels. Now, I'm not really sure if anybody here knows the size of a bushel, because neither did I. It's a sack of grain is about a bushel. And I have a manure spreader that is 300 bushels, so that would be like 300 sacks of grain. Still really doesn't make any difference. But the one thing I do know for sure, that if you fill that manure spreader full of liquid manure and accidentally leave the hydraulic paddle on, or not the paddle, but the drive for the bottom, and go down the highway, it will unload itself in exactly 1.3 kilometers, at exactly 6 feet wide and 3/4 of an inch thick. And I did that this summer. I thought, man, I'm going to make the paper again. This is going to be great. Yeah. I got to visit with a lot of old neighbors that hadn't called me in a long time. Yeah, pretty happy with me. Part of that what Luann was saying about dumb farmers, or maybe we got a little, you know, shit for brains or something like that. Well, that day I think I did. I guess the greatest education I got was from my maternal grandparents. They arrived here in the 30s. They kind of came a different route. My grandmother came as a nanny, and she actually worked for, I think it was the Lakes family in Nelson in 1930. And my grandpa came here, and he was promised a job in Halifax, and when he got there, the man couldn't help him. It was a depression. Gave him $4 and told him to hop a freight and head out to the prairies. So my grandpa did. He rode in the boxcar, you know, for free, just like a lot of other people did at that time. But he didn't get off in the prairies. He got off in the Slocan Valley. And he worked for a month or two as a laborer on a track gang, but he wasn't really built for that. He was a smaller guy. So he came to Nelson, and by luck, he ended up getting a job for Blaylock Estates or whatever. And he's actually responsible for a lot of the rock work and quite a few of the trees that were planted in the 2 or 3 years that he was there. So he left his mark, or they left their mark here. But it's from them that I learned the most about farming. They were very, very frugal farmers too. But, you know, I grew up with them, so whereas the other grandparents were fairly old by the time I got there, these ones gave me a lesson. And Luann was talking about butchering. Well, my grandma, she was there with a bucket, collected the blood, and that girl, she went right from tongue to testicles to tail and disappeared with it in the house, and a little bit later you'd come out with something like cracklings or something that you'd eat, where she'd cook the blood with flour and salt, and it was really good. After I got a little older, I learned that if it was the testicles that she'd locked onto, I wasn't going to eat the soup for a couple of days, but besides that, it was not too bad. Another thing about Luann, which I should have said, is I think I told Bill about that thing about, because my grandma used to give the pigs a gallon of dandelion wine, and they would sit there and sing for a while, and then they'd go to sleep, and she'd cut the throat, and the blood would have a very interesting taste to it. I think it worked better for grandma. I never tried it. I wasn't going to waste good wine on a pig. But butchering really was, or I wasn't going to bring this up, but why not, eh? It's my 15 minutes. I was quite willing to let my kids and teach them young how to kill, how to clean. It's a skill they need to know. It's something they need to get over. My dad was just the opposite. Only once, of course there was a good reason for that, but only once, and I was 22 years old, before he'd actually let me shoot a cow. And this day happened to be, I had a new gun. It was there was this mini-series on TV where black powder rifles were in fashion. And I'd bought me a 50 caliber Hawkins gun in Lethbridge the week before, and I was going to show my dad just how butchering was done. So you're supposed to put 125 grains of powder in this. I figured, well, you know, a little's good and a lot's better. So I put about 250 grains of powder in this, jammed that bullet in there, lined up on the cow. It was looking through the fence. My dad and my brothers beside me, and let fly. Now, I'm not sure what went through that cow's head first watching this, but it wasn't the bullet because it bounced off. And we didn't see this because of, with the roar of the gun, I mean, that thing didn't have nothing on a howitzer. It was a flamethrower. It had it shot a flame 5 feet out the end of that gun. There was black smoke anywhere, and the roar, well, first of all, we were all in shock for about 4 or 5 seconds. And then we couldn't see the cow because all the smoke, like, where is it? And I'm not lying. This is the absolute truth. So we all run to the side about 15 feet before we could see the cow. Now, it was a red, white-faced cow. That's a Hereford. But at this time, it was a black-faced cow with all the unburnt powder, because there's a physics thing to that, but I didn't pay attention in school because I had a girlfriend. So there we are, a black-faced cow with this little red dot. Now, about the time we got to the side, the cow's mind had cleared. And it let out this ungodly beller, kind of mournful at first, a little sickly. And then it jumped the fence, and no word of a lie, we didn't see it for about 10 days because it just kept going. Yeah, and that's the last time my dad let me butcher a cow. Yeah. Could you kind of turn up the lights just for a sec? I just want to do one thing here. I'm kind of curious. There, I can see. Everybody just stand up for a second. Please, just indulge me. Everybody stand up. If your grandparents were farmers that made their a living on the farm, you know, not doing anything else, just strictly farmers, remain standing. If not, sit down. Okay, if your parents were farmers, stay standing. Wow. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Less than 10. How many farmers are here? Stand up again if you've sat down. Isn't that something? You know, during the last depression, it was funny that one of the speakers was talking about the financial markets, and really now they're worse now than they were during the Great Depression, or they have, graver implications. But I was reading that during the last depression, half of everybody that was in North America had a relative who lived on a farm. And of those, of the half that lived on the farm, 80 or 90% of them made their living farming. If we have a Great Depression now, you know, just in our area, we are, and this was a rural thing, this wasn't an urban thing, it was rural. If we have a Great Depression now, who's gonna produce the food? I mean, in my area, I kind of did another quick mental, in my area there isn't anybody who makes a living except the dairy farmers strictly from farming. Even myself, I have a little portable sawmill, and I don't feed myself completely out of the garden or with the cows. I used to when I had kids, maybe half or 60% or something, but not at all now. Now, if there's a depression, I really doubt if I could feed my own family, and I'm one of the few farmers that are in here. So it's very important that we pay attention, not just to me as farmers, but to your, even as yourself. If now is the perfect time to become a farmer. I mean, there's support. We've been ignored as farmers for 70 years, and we've been, you know, downtrodden. No, you're not downtrodden, but we've been ignored enough that we're non-existent, or just about non-existent. What I was getting at before, in my area, there are 14 bachelor farmers who own maybe 2,000 or 3,000 acres. That means they don't have any family to pass it on to, and the average age is about 70. So I really don't know. So what happens, and as a horse farmer, the only reason that I get away with it is because I have a neighbor who's probably the oldest surviving horse farmer in the province, maybe in the country, and his name is Stuart Fodery, and he was a famous horse logger farmer from Parksville, and he moved here. And if it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have a clue on how to do half the stuff that I know how to do. So anyway, it's food for thought. Okay. And I have something here that I wrote down. It's a little plagiarized, but it really fits in to what we're about and what we're here for tonight. The small farm does bring the family back to the table, both the farm family and the farm community. In food directly from the farm, prepared with artistry and local pride, and served in celebration to those who do the work, becomes a bonus payment to us, the farmer, of the highest order. People are looking for clear evidence of values they may connect with. They are interested in how we grow their food and why. To this end, the stories of our choices and concerns become important. In my case, heritage, true horse-powered organics, and family involvement. What we do is important. We are farmers. We feed people. How we do it is more important. True, sustainable, organic farming. Why we do it is the most important of all. Why is like an explosion of connected spiritual, economic, and physical reasons with a little magic sprinkled in, and when woven together, create community. I recently read, if someone dreams a dream alone, it's only a dream. However, if we all dream the same dream together, it's the beginning of a new reality. So here's to a new reality.
Keith Huscroft, speaking in September 2008 in Nelson, British Columbia. Keith is a fourth-generation farmer who farms in the Creston Valley in the area known as Lister. Keith is one of three farmers who grew grain for the community-supported grain project that we've been covering here for quite some time now on Deconstructing Dinner. To help celebrate the harvest and the success of the project, Deconstructing Dinner teamed up with the CSA to host the Kootenai Harvest Revival, which we've been listening to recordings from both on last week's show and today. You can expect more recordings from the two-day event on next week's show, and if you miss any of these episodes, they are, as usual, archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. That was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio program is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.